Welcome to episode 60 of the Listening Brain Podcast.
Welcome to the Listening Brain. I'm your host, Todd Houston. In this podcast, we explore childhood hearing loss through the lives of the parents and families who are on this journey and the professionals who serve them.
Today, I want to welcome to the podcast, Sydney Bassard. Sydney is a speech-language pathologist who specializes in working with individuals who are deaf and hard of hearing, as well as working on literacy skills. She owns the Listening SLP, her private practice and social media brand. Sydney also creates graphics to promote health equity of information. And if you've been on Instagram, I'm sure you have seen many of her posts and videos and reels and everything that she's doing under her brand name or her private practice, the Listening SLP. So I'm excited to have Sydney join me today. And I have to put in a plug, she's also a graduate of the master's program at the University of South Carolina in speech-language pathology, which is where I did my master's and PhD. So welcome to Sydney.
Hi, are you creative? Do you want to give a webinar or teach a course? Maybe you're a writer. Do you want to create a blog? Maybe you have an idea for a podcast. Whatever your passion is, we at 3C Digital Media Network want you to be a content creator so we can bring your ideas to life. So, to get started, visit our website at 3CDigitalMediaNetwork.com and sign up to be a content creator. We look forward to seeing your passions come to life on our platform.
Well, Sydney, welcome to the podcast. Would you mind sharing more about your background?
Yeah, so I am a speech-language pathologist by training, and I have been an SLP for 4 going on 5 years. My background and how I became a speech path is a little different than most. So traditionally, people do an undergraduate degree in communication sciences and disorders, and then they go on and get their master's. I actually have a bachelor's degree in public health. So I was a little bit of a late bloomer in figuring out I wanted to be an SLP. And then once I did one intro course into communication sciences and disorders, I knew that like this is kind of what I wanted to do. So after that, I ended up applying to my master's program. It took people that were non-majors. And so the rest has kind of been history from there.
That's so awesome. And I'll just, as a state of disclosure or a point of disclosure, we're both graduates of the University of South Carolina.
Yes.
And I too did not have an undergrad degree when I went into grad school. Excuse me. My background is in journalism and mass communication. So I had to do the similar thing when you went in there at USC. So what has brought you to this point now in terms of your area of focus?
Yeah. So at the University of South Carolina, they actually have an auditory verbal therapy track where students are able to really get a lot of exposure working with 2 certified AVTs, as well as working with their cochlear implant team and really getting a lot of hands-on experience. So when I was in grad school, I worked in a research lab, and the main focus of the research was looking at literacy, listening, and spoken language outcomes for children who are deaf and hard of hearing. And so naturally for me, it was fitting in line that I would apply to be on that AVT track. So I did that when I was in grad school and got a lot of experience working alongside those 2 AVTs, as well as being able to work with children, working with the audiologist directly, and being able to do a whole semester where I shadowed them and worked with them in the booth. And so that's really like kind of what sparked my interest. So I knew after that experience, like my dream job was going to be working on a cochlear implant team in a hospital. And so that's exactly what I got to do for my CF. I was really I was pretty determined and a little stubborn on not taking anything else that wasn't that. But it was a phenomenal experience. I have had no regrets in doing that. I worked on a fabulous team with ENT, audiology, nursing, social work, as well as the other SLPs within the hospital setting. And so it really just helped strengthen my skills, but also to really strengthen my skills within a team approach and what that looks like and how we all work within the system to better serve the families we're working with.
And we'll do a little plug here. Which team did you work with?
Yeah, so I worked on the team with the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughters in Norfolk, Virginia area.
Oh, yes. Yes. I'm familiar with that team. So from there, did you go straight into your, after the cochlear implant team, did you go into your private practice at that point, or was there a step in between?
There was a slight step in between, but we bypassed that. okay. I ended up pretty much going into private practice pretty shortly after I left the hospital and moved back to Charlotte, North Carolina area. And it has been wonderful. As a business owner, you have to make connections. So one of the biggest things that I was really committed to was learning about all of the different resources within North Carolina. So I went to Duke when they hosted events. I made sure to reach out from different people at universities, but then also looking at what supports were more localized to the Charlotte area. And it has been just such a blessing and wonderful experience for me. I have loved getting to really curate therapy to what I've always wanted to do, but then being able to have the flexibility to meet whatever needs the families really ask for.
Awesome. When I was in South Carolina, and in really afterwards too, for quite a number of years, there was not a lot of listening and spoken language clinicians in and around Charlotte. There just seemed to be a real dearth of really great places that we could refer families, because sometimes we would have families that would come down from Charlotte to Columbia for different reasons, and we would try to reconnect them with someone there. Hetty Kinney was one that worked, took some private practice kinds of patients, private practice patients, but it's always been a difficult city, or for some reason, what I've been able to put together over the years is that there's like one ENT practice that kind of owns everyone else. And that seemed to be not criticizing, just saying that in that situation, it seemed to be difficult to always get referrals or to make sure patients that come out of that team to really get connected to good services.
And you're 100% correct. I think that it has been, it's been kind of, I think even for me, I grew up in Charlotte, this is home, but being in places like where I was in Virginia, where I had a team or there were other people and resources I could kind of pull from, even if I myself didn't know everything, to come to Charlotte and we didn't have this abundance of research and resources that was kind of directly available was definitely a little hard and a bit of an adjustment to realize that you don't just have all of these people in programs and places you can pull from. And it shows the families tend to feel a little frustrated, or they're having to drive to Columbia, or sometimes they're driving to Raleigh-Durham area in order to kind of feel like they're getting their needs met. So I'm happy to be here to help the people that I can. And if I can't directly work with them, at least providing free resources to kind of get them in the right direction for where they need to go.
Right. It's really interesting that it hasn't really, now you're there being that light in the darkness to help guide families. But, over the years, I just always thought, what a large city that had so much. But this was one little area that it was still struggling. So I'm glad you're there and doing really great work. So that's awesome. So let's talk about your private practice and what you've been doing as you've gone into private practice, because you have a very very substantial presence, I would say, on Instagram, on social media, as the Listening SLP. How did that come about?
Yeah, so the Listening SLP started at ASHA in 2019 when it was in Orlando. I had been on my personal Instagram following a couple speech student accounts and a couple speech therapy accounts. And I was like, you know, I could kind of do something similar to this. I like Canva. I can play around with graphics. But I knew that there was a barrier to information. So we know that, like, Charlotte is not unique in the fact that there are not a lot of listening and spoken language, either fully, like, certified professionals or even people with clinical knowledge to know how they can best support people. And so oftentimes parents are having to wait a really long time to get in to see these providers, or the information is just not readily accessible. So that was the big thing for me, is just putting out little pieces of information that is quick, digestible, but it's actionable for people to be able to use it. So that's how the Listening SLP started on social, was what can I do in order to help other people? And it's kind of evolved over time into what we see today, where my platform is really just big on listening to people, learning alongside people, and then helping them to be able to be better advocates for themselves and their children. So those are the hallmark principles of my practice. It has been really fun to get to work alongside families and really see, a lot of times by the time, unfortunately, people have found me or they're coming to me, they're really at their wits' end. They've gone and they've seen other people, or they have tried a bunch of different things and they're like, we just don't know what to do. So my goal always is, one, like, let's figure out what exactly your needs are. Where is it that you want to see your child go within the next 3 to 6 months? And I always say 3 to 6 months because we can ask parents, what do you want for your kid? And every parent is going to tell you they want their child to be successful. I don't know any parent that doesn't want that for their kid. But if we can make it smaller, then we can make it more measurable. What is our plan for 3 months? What is our plan for 6 months? And that helps the parents to kind of center and be a little bit more realistic with our expectations of what we're expecting this child to do. And then after 3 months, we kind of say, like, did we meet these goals? Did we not meet these goals? What adjustments do we need to make? I'm also big on breaks. So I think families like that too, because after about 3 or 6 months, sometimes it might be a little longer, I always recommend that we take a little bit of time off, because the brain is absorbing so much information when you're working with a speech therapist or another professional. In order for the brain to truly develop and grow, we have to give it time without those supports. If we always have those supports there, you will never see how much they're able to do independently without them there. And my goal is not to be a lifelong speech therapist for these families. So we always take breaks, and then we come back and say, like, how did we maintain the skills that we've been working on? What things do we need to adjust? How did the past 2 weeks to a month ago. So I think people really like that too, because it allows the family to see, wow, my child has really, like, maintained a lot of these skills, or they've really grown within this time that we've been working together. And it helps empower the families to really kind of carry on those things that you've been working on in therapy.
I think that's a wonderful strategy to use, the breaks and looking at 3 months at a time or so, and just measuring progress. And I agree 100%. I think it's a great way to basically keep parents focused, but not overwhelm them. And we all see parents that are very, very overwhelmed for just lots of different reasons beyond just having a child with hearing loss and trying to just navigate life and work and, you know, babysitting or transportation or whatever the other issues might be. I really like that strategy. And I've kind of done the same thing, because I have grad students that work with me, and we kind of have a semester and sort of timeline. So it ends up being about a 3 to 4 month period, and we take a little break and we come back other, you know, 3 to 4 months and take a break and come back. So it kind of is built in, because I mostly follow a university schedule in most situations, in most holidays, not always. And so I have seen exactly what you're talking about, the overwhelmed, but also breaking it down and more measurable, doable, goals, and I think parents really appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your caseload, I noticed you're also very interested in literacy and dyslexia, or other areas that you focus on. I know from, you mentioned the research lab you're working in, looking at literacy when you're in grad school. Is that where that comes from?
So that, my love of literacy is a little bit more personal. So I have a brother who is around 8 years younger than me. And when I was actually an undergrad, he was diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD. And so kind of seeing some of his struggles, but then seeing how with really good structured intervention, he was able to make leaps and bounds. I mean, he went from reading at like, I think a third grade level, or probably lower when he's in the sixth grade, to being beyond grade level with his reading skills based on standardized measures. So that's where that love came from. And then it just kind of flourished from there. South Carolina has a really good team. I got to learn from some of the best in the field as far as like researchers, what is going on with literacy. Suzanne Adloff, who's still there, was phenomenal. And I still love being able to read her research and interact and chat with her. So that's where that came from. And then it just kind of carried. And it has really been important for me to like stick with the literacy, especially pairing it with knowledge about hearing loss. And as these kids get older, we know that they've traditionally to have reading difficulties. So making sure that we're incorporating some of those things from the very beginning with intervention to help them so that they are more successful with their reading journey later on.
I think that's wonderful. I think I've always viewed sort of what we do is ultimately the ultimate sort of evaluation, so to speak, of what we do as clinicians in this sort of world of hearing loss is, do they become competent readers? And are they able to do that? So they need the listening and spoken language, but how well are they doing with literacy? Because if we do all this work and they can't develop literacy, then that's going to be a terrible situation for these kids. As we know, as you mentioned, that they often have issues with literacy. So, I really applaud you putting, you know, sort of integrating literacy from, you know, from day one, making sure that you're sort of touching on all of that developmental sort of literacy skills as you're working with these families. I think that's really incredible. And then when you get into dyslexia, it's sort of a hot issue right now, more generally. And I think a lot of SLPs really struggle with, how do I work with kids with dyslexia, or even like your brother, even, you know, adults who have dyslexia? So I think that's another great area that you've sort of carved out for yourself.
Yeah, thank you. And I feel for SLPs. I always encourage like families when they are having to go through IEP meetings. You know, right now there's a lot of talk of like speech therapists can work with reading disorders too. And that's 100% true. But just like anything, you need proper training. And I don't think the general public fully understands that our profession trains us in these programs to work from birth all the way through end of life type of care. And so there are lots of things that we should know or could know, but they may get lost in the middle if that's not something that you're constantly seeing or working with. So I just always encourage people to have a little bit more grace when they are interacting with professionals that maybe don't know a whole lot about it. And then always encourage SLPs to see if they can find continuing education. But if they're finding that this is recurring on their caseload, like that's when we have to talk to the people in power and let them know that like you need more support so that you can properly do your job.
Yeah, I agree. I think just from a training program perspective, you know, it's really difficult to try to get everything in those 2 years or so, and for a master's degree. And, you know, it's just crazy. I mean, even when I was trained 30 years ago, it was a very, you know, full curriculum, as you know, from USC, 72 graduate hours or something, 78 at the time. And so it's just a hard to sort of keep all that in your head. And I do see that a lot of SLPs, you know, when you start talking about literacy, you know, sometimes their eyes just kind of glass over. It's like, yeah, we talked about that. I had a class in it, but that's not really what I'm doing. I'm doing some of the stuff, but not, I don't want to be seen as the reading specialist in my public school that I'm working in. And that's the fear. And so I think we have to do more in that area to relieve the stress that's out there around literacy and how we work with those kids.
Agreed.
So, yeah. And then, yeah, and the whole dyslexia is a whole other thing, too, that's people get really scared about. It's kind of, how do we do it? How do we approach this? And again, it may be two lectures on it in grad school, you know, where they talked about it. And maybe they had a client or maybe not. You know, it may be in practice before they first encounter anyone that has dyslexia.
So and realizing it's a spectrum and it's right. Not like it's the label, but just like with other things, like there's degrees and not everybody is severely dyslexic. There are people that are a little bit more mild dyslexic, but what does that look like for intervention approaches? And what do we need to do in order to kind of meet those individual needs?
Right, right. Back in my day, I sound like Grandpa Jones here, but the way training programs were structured then was that you had to, what ASHA requires, you had to get so many hours in each area. So many fluency hours, so many oral habilitation hours, so many, you know, so it was really broken down into all these different disorders. And then they did away with that and basically said, you need child speech, child language, you know, adult speech, adult language in these areas. And now suddenly, our grad students go through a whole grad program and they may get all of their child speech and child language hours without kids with hearing loss, without kids with dyslexia or whatever. So in one sense, we've continued to make students generalists. But at the same time, I think we've lost something because we can't guarantee that they're going to get really good exposure because of the way it's now set up in mm-hmm. terms of graduate training. So, and it's always sort of that, you know, give and take, because we can't train every single thing and go into the depth that we want to at the graduate level. And so it's, you know, my personal opinion is that I think we're going to have to go to a clinical doctorate eventually. It's just so much information to try to keep up with.
Well, and we have like SimuCase. So like when I was in grad school, SimuCase was like starting to emerge. I was on the tail end mm-hmm. of where you still had to get all of the hours for the different categories. And then I think shortly after I finished is when they transitioned to like, it just has to be general child speech or general child language. So I definitely remember where I was like, I've not seen anybody with fluency. And they're like, all right, well, in order to get these hours, hop on SimuCase or do this or do that in order to kind of meet those qualifications. But I am of the same philosophy. I think having just like in most healthcare professions, we need people that are generalists, right? Everything does not require you to go see the specialist. But when we are expecting SLPs to be experts in childhood apraxia of speech, in hearing loss, in feeding disorders, that is in order to truly be able to competently treat all of those things, you need to have pretty in-depth knowledge of it. And our grad programs are giving us what they can give us within that short time period, but then it's requiring you to be deeper, but you can't go and be the knowledge bank for every single thing in depth. Like your brain capacity is just not going to allow you to do that. So
exactly.
Like I think that moving to where we have a clinical doctorate or looking more into how we can have standardization for specialties is going to be the way that we not only thrive as a profession, but we're helping people to practice at the top of their license and not feel as though they're just like skimming by.
Very good point. Yeah, I agree 100%. I think have either clinical doctorate or ways to specialize at the graduate level. You know, if you know in your heart of hearts you're going to work with children, maybe not take some of the adult classes, but, you know, it's some, you have some designation that that's not your area or something, you know, it has to be looked at, I think. But it'll be interesting over the next, I would say, 5 to 10 years, 5 years, really. I think if we don't sort of start moving to that, we're starting to see graduate programs have a clinical doctorate and promote clinical doctorates. And it's similar to how the AUD started with audiology. So I do think it's going to come eventually. So I want to ask you maybe a little controversial question. Is that okay?
Go for it.
Okay. So this is going back to social media and some of the posts that are out there, not your posts. But, you know, I'm seeing a lot of SLPs and others talk about kids with hearing loss and how there's this language deprivation. And what they're getting at is we have to use sign language from the beginning without anything else, you know, to make sure that these kids do not experience language deprivation. And I, my personal opinion is that it's, you know, you're not helping the children or the families in the sense that parents still need to decide what they want for their child and have choices. But it's interesting to see how this whole language deprivation is coming about. And then also with, I don't know if you've experienced this or not, but some of the neurodiversity issues that are out there are also being kind of applied to deafness, that I'll let them be a part of their culture in this, and then the language deprivation perspective. And so I'm just wondering what's your take on it, what you've noticed, and if you've run into any of that yet.
Yeah, so that is definitely a hot button topic. I think when it comes to anything on social media, right? Like the people that are the loudest are going to be the ones that you hear the most. And the way that social media work for people who are not as like avidly on there is the algorithm boosts things. And so what happens on the algorithm is if somebody just shares something, but it doesn't get traction, meaning people are not liking, commenting, engaging with it, like it might do okay. But the minute that people are starting to like, comment back at people, whether it's good and they agree, whether it's that they're not stating that they agree, or whether it's just flat out bad, like it is boosting it in the algorithm for more people right. to see. And then even behind the scenes, when you're sharing things with your friends and saying, can you believe so-and-so said this, that, and the third, it is boosting it to be louder and louder on social media. So I think that's something always important for people to remember. My like goal over the past year has been, it's okay to let it go. It is okay to not have to comment. It's okay to like see something, be like, wow, I don't really agree with that, without having to always voice your opinion or feel like you need to like have deep and depth conversation about it, because everyone is entitled to their opinion. I think when it comes to the language deprivation thing, sometimes the way that it's phrased is almost in a way to like scare parents about what like potentially could happen to their child. Because just like we know with any language, ASL is its own language system. You could have a child that is not developing ASL as we would expect them to, and could experience delays, just like we see with listening and spoken language. It's the same thing. And so we don't know how a child is going to develop language. This is even with typical hearing children, until we actually start trying to teach them and work with them. So I am always of the mindset of like, you give people their options, you tell them what their options are, and then you work within their comfort level of what they decide for their family. If you personally and professionally feel like you can't do that, then that's when you need to help them find somebody that's going to be able to support their needs. Not shame or scare people into your way of thinking about things, because at the end of the day, this is not your child. This is not your child. Right. You are a professional. And I think sometimes people struggle with the disconnect between their personal beliefs and professionally what they should be enlightening people on.
I think
so. That was the first part of your question. And then I forgot the second part of it.
I don't remember. No, I think you covered it. I think it was great. I've seen this whole perspective starting to get sort of more traction in different areas and different situations. Mm-hmm. And even in my clinical work here at Akron Children's Hospital, where sometimes that comes up, and we always want to honor and respect the choices that parents make, and like you're saying, connect them to the providers that they need if that's what they want. At the same time, if a family came in and said, "Oh, we're gonna," usually, you know, hearing parents that have a child with hearing loss, and usually, often there's no history of hearing loss in the family, and suddenly they want to do ASL. Well, who's gonna work with them? Where do we refer them to teach, you know, to get services, or someone's going to teach them ASL so that they can be fluent enough to be language models for their children? It becomes a difficult task for a family to do, even if they want to do it. And I think it's sometimes not viewed as, oh, this is a beautiful language. It's a language of Deaf culture. Let's honor this. Let's, you know, help the child do this. But once sort of putting that in place is not the easiest thing in the world. So I think that's where some of the stuff I've seen online, you know, thinking about, you know, language deprivation, you need to do this. Well, it's almost like setting the family up for failure. Well, what if they wanted to do something like that? Where are they going to go? Where are the resources to be able to tap into a deaf culture person, you know, someone who's a deaf person who's in deaf culture, or someone who's, you know, maybe an interpreter who can teach ASL, or another deaf person who can teach ASL. That's mm-hmm. not easy to obtain, not easy to find. So that's sort of been my perspective. You know, I do honor, and what I've always said, if, you know, choose what you want and then go all in. Think about what you want. And then if that's truly what you want for your child and your family, then you have to go all in.
Yeah. And the cost barrier too. I think people sometimes forget, like, with all of these different things, there's potentially a cost associated with it. So what does that look like? I do remember the mm-hmm. second part where we talked about, with the neurodiversity movement and how yes. that's kind mm-hmm. of looking like with, the deaf culture and community. I think the biggest thing is sometimes it's really easy, especially as like the hearing person, to have your thoughts and opinion on it. My thing is, that is not my battle to fight. Like, how people choose to identify with their culture and community is their own identity. And if someone is a bilateral cochlear implant user and they want to identify that they are part of the deaf community, then like that is what we should let them do, whether they sign, whether they SIMCOM, like that is 100% their identity and how they choose to identify. And it just gets very interesting to see how other people almost want to codify or classify somebody else's there. Until you have ever walked right. a mile in that person's shoes, you don't know what it's like to be them. So it's best that you just, like, you allow people to go through their own journey in life, and you can support them, you can provide them resources, but you don't have to have an opinion on how they choose to identify or not identify. I think the conversation gets really intricate. I think for me, when people are talking about no amplification or reducing amplification for children, and then, you know, well, they're adults that feel some type of way about it, who like sure. at one point in life they were using amplification, and then as an adult they've decided not to. I think that puts parents in a tough situation. Unfortunately, we know that, like, if listening and spoken language is ever the goal, early amplification has found to be, like, scientifically, it's improving the outcomes for these kids. Whatever choice you decide to make as an adult is 100% your choice to do. But to like shame people on the internet for choosing to implant or provide their child with any type of amplification because as an adult, you decided that you don't want to use it or you had bad experiences, you are projecting your experiences onto another person. And that's also unfair.
I agree 100%. And I think, as you very, very eloquently stated, the situation, you know, what I've often talked to parents about is, and if you meet someone who's 40 years old, 45 years old, and they're a member of deaf culture, and that's how they identify, it's great. But their experience as a young child is very different than what we do today. You know, they may not have benefited from early intervention or early use of technology because then it wasn't in place and where they lived, or it wasn't as comprehensive in terms of the degree of services. You know, there wasn't newborn hearing screening. There wasn't that early identification. And so their whole life experience is very different than what your child will have because, you know, we've identified them at, you know, 2 weeks old, you know, whatever the case may be. And so it's putting all those different perspectives in perspective, so to speak. It's helping families understand that. And I think that's been one of the areas, too, that has come up from time to time, not often, but from time to time. But yeah. So, Sydney, what I wanted to ask you, as we start to wrap up, I know you're busy and probably need to get to a million things. What advice would you give to those graduate students, maybe going into the University of South Carolina or coming out of, who really want to do this work? What would you advise them to do?
I would advise them to recognize that you have a lot of clinical knowledge. You have worked very hard to achieve your degree. You've worked really hard to learn all about listening and spoken language and how to best support these families. Now what you have to do is almost untrain your brain from all this clinical knowledge a little bit and open it up to listen. We come in sometimes, especially as a new grad, I was like this for like, I know what to do. I've worked really hard. I'm going to change the world. And that's a great attitude to have. But what we sometimes forget is that what the family is bringing to the table, you have to meet them there. So realizing that you can have all of this knowledge and stuff, but being open and being flexible to how can you adapt it to meet the needs of the person that's sitting in front of you.
Excellent. Couldn't be better stated. Well, thank you today for your time and having such a great conversation. And best of luck to everything you're doing there in Charlotte.
Thank you so much. This was a great conversation. I really appreciated it.
Well, that was Sydney Bassard, the listening SLP. It's so exciting to see and be able to speak with a younger, yes, most people are younger than me, a younger clinician, speech language pathologist who has a passion for working with children with hearing loss. It really warms my heart to see that. So definitely you want to watch the listening SLP, watch Sydney. She has a lot to offer, and I expect her to just keep doing the many, many great things that she is doing. So check out what she has to offer and send her some love. And with that, thank you for listening to this episode. I really appreciate your support of this podcast. And if you don't mind, leave a 5-star review. That helps us to move up in some of the rankings that happens over there on Apple Podcasts and some of the other platforms. And that helps us attract new listeners. So any of those reviews would be very, very helpful. And until next time, be safe and be kind. This has been a production of the 3C Digital Media Network.